tie right next to you.
Okay, we're good. Good morning. It's a lovely day in March. It's March 3rd. And if I knew Shakespeare, I'd be quoting the Ides of March and to make sure Macbeth, not yet, but Macbeth.
That's not till the 15th.
Yes, but
very
Macbeth
preparation.
Macbeth has to watch that forest a long time before he could tell whether it's moving or not. And so it's the same thing here at the legislature. We don't really always know what's moving and what's not. Of course, I hope nobody's planted their vegetables until St. Patrick's Day. That's, you know, you got to have all these things that we do right. Okay, enough of that. I am going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017, and that is a budget bill for the Oregon Department of Education and the State School Fund Bill. Doug, tell us about what you're going to give us, the short version of what Superintendent Saxon is going to tell us for an hour, so just make it brief.
Madam Chair, members of subcommittee, I think Mr. Saxon will be here more than an hour. This is scheduled really for the next 2 weeks, these two bills together. Keep in mind they represent between 41 and 42% of the general fund lottery fund budget. So you got the big chunk of the dollars here. On your O-list for today, you'll find a number of documents, including materials from us on both the budget of the department as well as the state school fund. The document you really do want to take a look at is the one which is the third one down after the agenda, which is the ODE presentation. That's what will be up on the screens. As I said, this represents by far the largest portion of the budget of any area in state government. Also that the approach taken between the co-chair's framework and the governor's budget is significantly different. In terms of the state school fund, the co-chair's number is $7.24 billion, while the governor's budget is about $325 million less than that for the state school fund at about $6.91 billion. In contrast, the department's budget in the governor's budget is about $230 million more than what the co-chairs have assumed in their framework. And I say assumed because the subcommittee does have the will be instructed by the co-chairs to look at priorities within that overall budget that they did not set specifically. The difference between the co-chairs' framework assumptions and the governor's budget are mainly in grant and aid payments, both in the K-12 area as well as significant increases in early learning. Some major issues for you to think about over the next 2 weeks. In 2013, the legislature passed House Bill 3232 and 3233, which were both strategic investments in education, sort of again starting that approach toward more focused investments away from not putting everything in the state school fund. These generally went out as competitive grants on the most part, and they included reading initiatives, STEM and CT investments, regional collaborations like Eastern Promise, and accelerated learning and student mentoring, a number of investments. Then there were also, from 3233, investments in something called the Network for Quality Teaching and Learning, which are quite a few different professional development-related programs, the largest being continuation of district collaboration and teacher mentoring programs, which made up the bulk of that funding. For both of these types of investments, there are probably a number of questions you need to keep in the back of your head, which have been effective or not. Should the resources be reprioritized? And actually, though, have these initiatives, some of which are just a little bit over a year old, been around long enough to really gather enough information to make those judgments? The other question is, how much should we continue to put money into these or invest more and more? Few of them have grown rather quickly. Things like CTE, two biennia ago, had less than $2 million going to them. The governor's budget grows from the current $11 million per biennium by adding another 14.7 on top of that. So there's quite a bit of growth in some of these programs, and is there been enough time to judge their effectiveness, and or is it more attuned to looking at the demand for the grants and making the decision based on that? Also, there are staffing patterns attached to many of these investments, as if you do change them, keep in mind we're going to have to take a look at the staffing patterns to make sure that they maintain at the level required under any new or revamped investment priorities. Early learning, one of the big questions you'll need to discuss, and I'm sure there'll be quite a bit of discussion, is early learning hubs. These are relatively new. And they are a system sort of based on the CCOs in the medical field, and they're responsible for coordination and other functions at the level, local level. There's 16 of them. 14 have been selected. They're working on the last two. But keep in mind that the oldest one here in Marion County, it's been around the longest, it's been around for about 11 months. So we're talking about something with not a long track record. So there's also significant investments, not only in these hubs, but also in other early learning programs in the governor's budget to look at. We heard a lot of that over the last week, over those first 3 days. In terms of the department budgets, again, assessments will be a big issue to take a look at to make sure there's a proper amount of funding for the Smarter Balance set of assessments. These are replacing the Oaks assessment tools, and the question will be, will these continue? I mean, there's a whole set of policy issues outside of the budget, but once those are settled, we need to make sure there's sufficient resources in the budget for the department to administer those and to send money out to the districts for their and other contractors for their providing to the students. Providing is maybe a word that the students would agree, not necessarily agree with, since they have to take the tests. There's a number of information systems issues in this agency or partner agencies. There is a statewide regional data or longitudinal data system that which was sort of authorized last year. It's not been getting off the ground as fast as some would like to see it. And the other major area is probably in early learning, where there are significant needs that are just beginning to sort of gel out, and there'll be investments over there over for the next few years in that area. And finally, the Oregon School for the Deaf, not necessarily budget issues, but this subcommittee last year had some real questions around the performance and the student outcomes around the School for the Deaf. It'd probably be good for you to take a look at those as you get to that in this budget presentation. So the schedule is to hear these two bills for the next 2 weeks. We combine these and the state school fund. The basics of the state school fund will be part of this presentation that the department provides. And we will likely schedule public testimony, I'm thinking Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. But I think we'll make that decision tomorrow morning. I'll talk to the sub-chairs. I'd like the agency to get a little further into their presentation so you have some background based on what will be coming forward in public testimony. So we will try to set that sometime tomorrow for the public to know. So, Madam Chair, I would suggest you turn it over to the Deputy Superintendent at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. At this time, it is my pleasure to invite our Deputy Superintendent forward, and I don't know if you're going to have some other people. Oh, sure, here we come. Good. Oh, gosh. Just you, Rob?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. You don't want Ozzy?
I'd love to have Ozzy up here.
Oh, okay. But I'm not going to say anything more, because it sounds like you've got a lot to share with us. And so if you proceed, and good morning.
Good morning. Co-chairs Compton, Monroe, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Saxon, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. For Oregon, it's a pleasure to be here in what's scheduled to be I believe, 8 days of presentation on the high-level budget information of the Oregon Department of Education. As I sit here before you today, I'm a few months away from completing my third year as the appointed deputy superintendent. And preparing for this presentation gave me an opportunity to reflect back on the exciting and eventful last 2.5 years. 2 years ago, I told you that I had accepted this appointment because I'd been frustrated with where we'd been going with education in the state, and that I was very excited about the possibilities of where we could go. And today, I continue to be excited about where we are, what we've accomplished together to date, but also because I believe that we've begun to move the system of education in the state. And I can see what we're capable of becoming and what it will do for our future and for our students and for our collective future as a state. Upon my arrival at the Department of Education, I had a number of thoughts, but primarily I just fundamentally thought that we could do better at the department and in education. And I believe that we are. There will always be room for improvement, and we will improve. The department has a significant level of complexity. I was...
Rob, before you start, you mentioned that you're going to take a high-level look at all this. Just that the committee knows, just like with OEIB, please, if you have a question for Mr. Saxton, I'm sure he'll get us the information, because some of us don't necessarily want to fly over this. We want to get down in the weeds a little bit.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Also, as you go through this, if there are specific topics you really want to dive into, there is phase two of the budget process after the agency presentation. So if you have topics that you want to dive real deep into, let the co-chairs or myself know, and we'll make sure those get scheduled later in session.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you, Co-Chair Compton. Yes, it will be high level, and I know that there'll be lots of questions as we go along, or at least I hope that there will be, and I'll be able to answer some of those. And if I don't know a pretty precisely correct answer, I will tell you that, and we'll get you the information within 24 hours. And if we can't, we'll let you know what and why and when you'll expect a response. We'll
thank
do that
you.
Every day. Thank you. So the department is complex. I was struck by 42% of the state general fund budget. No wonder there's a high level of complexity. It tries to be so much to so many and has a real complex set of constituencies, and it's a very engaging place to work. Every component of our effort to improve education in the state needs to be high functioning. That includes the OEIB, early learning, youth development, school districts, schools, community college, universities, and the Department of Education. My commitment to you is that we will be, and that we'll pledge to do more than our part to ensure that our system is well supported. So there's plenty to cover, as I said, 8 days, so I'll get moving here. The general flow of the presentation will start with what we have to cover today, which will be a large overview of the department, our high-level budget, mission goals, objectives, strategic planning, and progress monitoring. And then this is a list of what we'll cover in future days. You won't be stuck with listening to me speak on every day. We also have the early learning division, so Megan Irwin will present for a day or two. And then we also have the youth development division, where Iris Bell will speak. And then there are people in the room who can help me if we end up with some questions that we could answer quickly, but I just don't happen to have the answer to while I'm up here. So I'm well supported. A few things about the Department of Education. Like other state agencies, we're created by statute, and as deputy superintendent, I'm the functioning head of the agency. The governor is the official state superintendent. It's a little bit of an unusual situation when compared to other states, and sometimes when I'm with other people who hold a position similar to mine in other states, and I tell them I'm the deputy superintendent, they're not sure what that means exactly. but when I tell them that I'm the head of the state education agency, the SEA, then they know exactly what I'm talking about. The department works with the State Board of Education, who's created by the legislature and who can adopt rules within the statutory authority given them under OAR Chapter 581. And the department has broad responsibilities as the SEA, the State Education Agency, under federal law. And I'll talk about a number of those responsibilities over the course of the presentation. We also have a major role in implementing the 40-40-20 vision. The OEIB is in charge of the what, and we have the muscle and the staff to carry out the how. And so that's how those two things fit together. I also will tell you that there are all kinds of acronyms in education, and I'll do my dead level best to actually say them out as opposed to, at least the first few times, as opposed to just spit those things out. And if I do that, please remind me, because I try really hard not to do that. You'll see on slides 4 and 5 a list of the wide range of duties that I've referenced already that we have under state and federal law. I'm not going to go into the whole list because I'll be providing more detail over the course of the presentation, but I do think it's important to mention a few which represent very significant pieces of work that we do at the department. So things like the adoption of standards for each of the content areas, including English language arts, math, music, social studies, science, physical education, and more. Guiding school improvement efforts and professional development in order to increase student outcomes. Developing and delivering the statewide student assessment system and reporting on school results using that system. Ensuring students with disabilities are served according to their special needs in federal and state law. Distribution of the state school fund. Helping districts comply with federal law through monitoring and technical assistance. Operating the Oregon School for the Deaf. Ensuring healthy, nutritious meals are served to Oregon school children in various settings. And we also contract with local education programs to ensure students in closed custody facilities like Hillcrest and McLaren are provided educational services while they're in those facilities.
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, sorry.
Yes, Representative
Confused
Huffman.
On my days. Thank you. Rob, if you could also sometime work in the students that we relocated out of School for the Blind and give us an update on how they're doing, if they're getting the resources they need, etc.
Co-Chairs Kaufman, Monroe, Representative Huffman, yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to do that, and that is an important question. So be sure to do that. The pre-K systems are made up of what you see here on this slide. So 4,420 licensed child care facilities. Our local schools, there are 1,266 of those. Education service districts, 19, and other local providers. Our teachers, administrators, and other local employees, and of course the most important part of the system, over 230,000 children under age 5 and more than 500,000 students in K-12. I know that you've seen this slide before. I was speaking the other day with one of our legislators who asked me about what the organization really looks like if you have a more traditional model, and I'll try to bring one of those in as well. And then where does OEIB fit within this? And if I was going to put OEIB on this, I would put it off to the side of the governor, OEIB, where the little arrow out there to the side goes, and then there would be arrows to both to the youth development, deputy superintendent, which is ODE, and then the Early Learning Division as well. And that would sit between the governor and each of those.
Mr. Saxon, I think Senator Roblin has a suggestion on the structure, the organizational structure. Could you give that to him?
Well, we'll wait and see. We're having a work group starting tonight on
okay.
that. And so I would I think Rob has some people that will be there. So. We are going to have a real conversation. Representative Taylor hopefully will be there as well. And we have a wide variety of stakeholders from throughout the state to have a conversation about how does that – we have in front of us on the policy committee the decision to make whether we extend the sunset on OEIB and or whether we change it. And so there's a lot of conversations going on right now amongst a lot of people, and I don't want to – influence too much yet.
Okay.
So I will let those people bring with them what their concerns are and whatever, and then we'll move from that to come up with what I hope will be a consensus of a lot of people about how to do this. We've made a lot of changes in the last few years, and I think it's time to take stock and having a conversation about what that looks like for the future. So,
thank you, Senator Roblin. And because, Rob, what I find interesting is a co-chair Monroe and I have been doing this for a couple of years, and when we first started talking about OEIB, and Doug wasn't with us in all those meetings, but on the whiteboard in LFO, we just had OEIB and nothing else around it, and so over the last 4 years, that has changed each year. So I'd be interested in seeing what the changes have been each year and how that, yes, sir, just a minute.
Oh, you saw it, okay.
I was a teacher.
And I was a student, can you tell?
And I know which office you sat in. But seriously, for the, and we do have quite a few new committee members. What's your thought on that, Co-Chair Monroe? Do you think that'd be helpful?
Sure.
Okay. Because we looked at that plain whiteboard for quite a while.
I remember that.
Yeah, and we said, well, what's it going to look like? And they, it just had OEIB. So, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Rob, there's nothing behind this question, but it's just been a curiosity question along with what Madam Co-Chair was asking.
Comp.
If you could also point out for me where the Chief Education Officer, which bill that was called out in, because I have actually chief-sponsored and co-sponsored a lot of the bills the last couple of biennia. And I didn't recall until the governor hired Rudy that there was actually a position. So if you could just point that out sometime when you do the rest of it, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you want to ask him more?
No, just co-chairs, Representative Huffman. We'll do that, and I think I may have that today, actually. And if I don't, I'll be sure to have it tomorrow.
Okay.
Okay. So the main point of this simply is that what we've tried to do is put anything that has to do with serving students directly in the middle and then have support function around it. And honestly, the Youth Development Division and the Early Learning Division are also right in the Office of Learning as part of that for the student populations that they support. And then we have the function, the back office function, if you want to call it that, the Deputy Superintendent Business Function, Technology and Research, supporting each of those things. So right into these next four slides, there's slides 8 through 11 are intended to provide high-level budget information. Slide 8 illustrates the funding sources in the 13-15 budget approved by the legislature 2 years ago. The biggest chunk at 78%, which represents $6.76 billion, is the general fund. Another big chunk is lottery fund at 4% and $369 million. And nearly all of those funds go out to schools through the state school fund. Federal funds make up 12%, just over $1 billion. Non-limited federal funds make up 4%. I always ask when I see this, what's non-limited mean? And so non-limited means that it has to do with the nutrition program. And basically the federal government says, however many free and reduced lunch students you have, we're going to provide a resource so that we make that happen. And so if you have more students who end up needing free and reduced lunch, then there's more resource in that fund. But it was made up about 4% over the course of the last biennium. Other non-limited funds make up 1%, and then there's 2% in other funds. You'll see a total of 485.39 FTE. As I go through this presentation, I'll show you FTE by each office so that we can be clear about the number of people that we're talking about. Oftentimes, you'll see also position, so it says 519 position and then FTE. I typically try to stay away from positions because I want to know how many full-time people we have, not how many people are in the building at any given time or could be in the building at any given time. Slide 9 is really a similar pie chart but represents the 15.
Yes, Rob, Representative Smith-Warner.
I was trying to track that, but just to go back quickly to that positions and operations, is that operations number a subset of positions or in addition to?
Yes, Co-Chairs Compton-Monroe, Representative Smith-Warner, it is a subset of the positions. Okay. So basically what we've done there around operations is subtracted out the School for the Deaf and Youth Corrections.
So it's 519 overall, and of that 519, 432 are operations, 83 are School for the Deaf, and 4 are Youth Corrections.
Precisely.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Great question.
I should have done that math.
Thank you. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Rob, I'm also going to be interested in how many FTE are unfilled positions and how long they've been vacant, and if there's a current search going on for, you know, some of them I understand they're high level, and some of the agencies we deal with do national searches, and it takes 6 to 12 months to fill a position. So just interested in those numbers.
Yeah, great questions. Thank you. Okay. Slide 9 is very similar. Represents the 15-17 current service level budget of nearly $9 billion. And you really don't see any changes between the 13-15 approved budget and the 15-17 current service level budget on a percentage basis. Here you'll see 468 FTE, down from the previous slide of 485. So again, here's the previous slide with 485 FTE, and then this one with 468 FTE. That's because of what are called limited duration positions. So we have some positions that are limited duration. And really, those positions are for people who work but have a set of work that we believe will be completed over the course of the biennium. A really good example for us is, out of the last session, we got some dollars to do some work on what we called the class size collection. So it was a collection of data about how big class sizes are in various subjects and in the multiple grade levels. And we needed some people to do that collection, assemble the data, and make it usable so that people could understand what our class sizes look like and where and what across the state. Those people have completed that work and therefore had a limited duration position. We wouldn't need them to continue on in that work. Another example of that would be in the early learning division, and I know that you'll hear about that a fair amount when Megan Irwin talks about the early learning division due to the Race to the Top grant dollars that we have. And so there are grant dollars that will go away, and those positions are of limited duration, and those positions are included within the FTE that I'm representing here. Of the just under $9 billion in state, federal lottery, and other funds, ODE uses about 2% of those funds for department operations. The rest is distributed to schools and programs serving students locally. So 76% is school funding, 17% grant and aid, 4% is the early learning division, and then there's less than 1% each in the youth development division, school for the deaf, and youth corrections. It's important for you to know that federal funds make up a significant portion of the funds coming to ODE, and that comes with strings attached and does drive a lot of our work. I think that this is an interesting graph. You can see that the department receives about $1.4 billion in funds from the U.S. Department of Education, Agriculture, and Human Services. And the flowchart is a little bit challenging here, but it's federal funds. And if you could follow it really smoothly, you know, it just wouldn't be very exciting. So there's about $500,000 that goes to the Department of Education all the way out to the left, the farthest left red, that goes to the Oregon School for the Deaf, and that's primarily for special education services, or IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. And then the next red one over is $2.2 million that goes to youth corrections, and that's Title I-D Neglected and Delinquent Youth Funds. And then I'm going to take you all the way up, all the way over to the far right, the big blue box that says districts and ESDs, $1.042 billion. That goes primarily to districts and ESDs in the list of those things that exist. So Perkins, special education, long-term care and, care and treatment, IDEA hospital services, and so forth. And then there's $71.6 million that goes to the Oregon Department of Education Operations. And those dollars are on the very bottom line, those blue boxes. And they flow through, it's the middle red box, and then run across, that's spread out across the bottom. And they go to $45.8 million to the Office of Learning, $5.6 to Information and Technology, $1.7 to Finance and Administration, $17.7 to the Early Learning Division, $0.5 million to the Youth Development Division, and $0.3 million to Research and Data Analysis. And then there are state agencies, which are the top blue box at $107.5 million. That really is to the Department of Human Services around federal child care and development funds, ERDC, employment-related daycare primarily. And then right below that is $183.83 million. $183.3 million, and that typically is around nutrition for other providers, so child care and adult care providers. hopefully that is a fairly detailed explanation of how those funds get distributed.
I was going to say we might need to go back there because I'm still calculating. But
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So, Rob, employee-related daycare that you mentioned, so all employee-related daycare monies come through the department and are passed through then?
Yes. Come through us, and then they're passed through to the Department of Human Services.
Follow-up? Go ahead. Clarification.
I'll just clarify. I believe ERDC also receives some general fund, which is directly appropriated to Department of Human Services, but the Child Care Development Grant funds flow into this department, Early Learning Division, and then a large share of those funds go to DHS.
Okay. I'll investigate further my question offline. Then.
Okay. And then the question that I had, Rob, so on the right-hand side on the blue list, what is the definition of districts and ESDs? Or I guess I want to clarify for myself, these are the fund mechanisms down below that go to every school district and ESDs just in those areas, so it's $1.4 billion in those areas that are listed.
Yes, Co-Chair. It is $1.042 billion, and then they go out to districts in those dollar amounts. So Elementary Secondary Education Act is $405.2 million.
And so tell me who that would be distributed to.
That would be distributed to districts and ESDs, and those funds are distributed on a...
Paint me a picture. How many, I mean, is it going to Salem-Keizer School District? Is that your definition of a school district?
My definition of a school district would be the 197 school districts exist across the state, and it goes out to all of those districts distributed on, formula basis.
And the 17 ESDs.
And the, yes, all the ESDs.
Thank you. That helps me.
Thank you.
You think I'd know this stuff?
So recent changes in education, slides 12 through 20 outline some of the changes. I apologize, it takes me 8 slides to do this, but there have been lots of changes in education recently. Over the past 4 years, which have also created some changes for our budget as compared to the previous biennia. So the first is the addition of the Early Learning Division within the Oregon Department of Education, which actually consists of several components and several steps. First was the establishment of by House Bill 4165 in 2012 of the Early Learning Council, so the council itself, which was created to oversee a unified system of early learning to ensure children enter school ready to learn. Then the creation of the Early Learning Division, so the division itself, within the Oregon Department of Education through House Bill 3234, which was in 2013. And then the Early Learning Director, who's appointed by the governor. The addition of the Youth Development Division, also within ODE, which is very similar and consists of similar steps and parts as did the Early Learning Division. So the establishment by House Bill 4165 in 2012 of the Youth Development Council, created to oversee services to school-aged children to age 20. And as we move through this session, there will be a bill asking to extend the length of service aged up to from age 20 to age 24. And supporting academic success and reducing criminal involvement is their charge. Then the creation of the Youth Development Division within ODE by 3231 in 2013, and the Youth Development Director, who also is appointed by the governor. Slides 15 and 16 contain many of the major changes in education that were begun in 2011, and these changes have each become significant and important work for the department. They are Senate Bill 253, which set 40-40-20 as our education goal by 2025. Senate Bill 552, making the governor the state superintendent of public instruction with the appointed deputy superintendent position. Then Senate Bill 909, establishing the OEIB, charged with creating a unified public education system from early childhood to post-secondary education, and Representative Huffman, the chief education officer, to help carry help the board carry out its functions in Senate Bill 909. And I'll double check on that and make sure that that language is actually included in there, so that it isn't just that I assume it's included in there, but that it is included in there. And so we'll do that this afternoon.
Thank you.
I guess you probably carried that when it was in the House.
Senate Bill 290, requiring a new system for evaluating educators, which was needed to be done by July 1, 2013. And this work is now underway statewide. It's being done in districts and education service districts and district offices across the state. The department helped develop and implement the evaluation system, and I'd be happy to deliver a more in-depth report on this important work at any future request. But the thought that all educators in the state of Oregon are now evaluated under a similar methodology, and that's been developed and implemented over the last couple of years, is a big and important piece of work, and I think has a lot of opportunity to influence how we go about teaching students and the effectiveness by which we do that. Senate Bill 248, allowing districts to collect the full weight for full-day kindergarten, was passed in 2011, and the kindergarten will be offered beginning in the fall of 2015, so this upcoming fall. And then House Bill 3362, establishing the Career Technical Education Revitalization Grant Programs, or CTE, as they're commonly referred to. Then in 2013, there were more changes, including two I already mentioned, the House Bills 3231 and 3234, which moved the Youth Development Division and the Early Learning Division into the department. The creation of House Bill 3232, directing strategic investments in early reading programs, guidance and support for post-secondary aspirations, and connecting to the world of work. We typically refer to these as the initiatives, the education initiatives. And then also the creation of House Bill 3233, establishing the network of quality teaching and learning. Other changes include securing a waiver from the Elementary Secondary Education Act, which most commonly is referred to as No Child Left Behind, or NCLB. This confused me for a while as a district superintendent, what the difference was between NCLB, ESEA, and there is absolutely no difference. ESEA is the official terminology, Elementary Secondary Education Act, and then we call it different things every time a new iteration comes out. So the last one was No Child Left Behind. And to secure a waiver from No Child Left Behind, we needed to do four things in the state. Create a new Oregon report card where we could more accurately account, put out a record of accountability around school and state performance. Identify and support low-performing schools, which we call focus and priority schools. They're the 5% for their Title I schools, so they are high-poverty schools, and it's the 5% of lowest performing are called priority, and the next lowest 10% are called focus schools, and we've need to develop a plan to support those schools on ways to get out of that status. The third was a new educator evaluation system, which is in use, I just talked about, and lastly, adopt college and career ready standards and an appropriate assessment aligned to those standards. And states getting a waiver from the Elementary Secondary Education Act could do that as they saw fit. The standards needed to be reviewed by USDOE, the U.S. Department of Education, to say, yes, these are of college and career level, and you have an assessment that will assess against that set of standards. So lots of flexibility about how you do that. They just needed to be high enough. Our waiver is still considered conditional in the state of Oregon because we've been working with the department, USED, to get an agreement on our educator evaluation process. We are assured that our current plan will meet the requirements set forth by USED. It actually has been an engaging and interesting process to get the waiver, especially around educator evaluation, and somehow I've sort of oddly enjoyed it, and it's been a good piece of work, certainly, in bringing our education partners together and talking about how you create good evaluation systems. In 2010, the Oregon State Board of Education adopted the Common Core state standards along with more than 40 other states at the behest of superintendents in the state. Statewide superintendents came together and really put pressure on the state board to adopt the Common Core state standards, as our college and career readiness standards referenced earlier, and with the adoption of those standards, we met the requirement to have college and career readiness standards to receive the waiver. And then Oregon as a state participated in the development of the assessment that would be used against that higher set of standards. And the assessment that we participated in the development of is the Smarter Balanced Assessment, and it was adopted as our assessment for the College and Career Readiness Standards in 2013. And it will be delivered to Oregon students for the first time this month in March. And I believe that kicks off on March 10th, actually.
I said beware of the Ides of March, so.
So why all of these changes? We live in a time that we call the information age. I think it's interesting that we name our own age. I don't think we used to do that, right? I don't think they sat around working with stone and decided to call it the Stone Age. But what they knew was that when they could use stone, that they were more likely to be able to provide for their family. They were the highest level of predator in the jungle or across the Serengeti or wherever they happened to live because they knew how to work with stone. And in the information age, the coin of the realm really is education, because your ability to work with information very much is tied to your level of education. And so we do live in an edu-economy, if you want to call it something, and how well we do with education in the state will really determine all of our futures collectively. We're working to improve. A coordinated P through 20 system makes sense. We've been too splintered for too long in the state, where we don't have good connections between early learning and K-12, or K-12 and our community colleges and higher education. And we also weren't achieving the outcomes that we wanted, and change was needed. In early childhood, over 45,000 children are born every year, and some of those are at risk for not being able to learn. Only half receive any services to ensure they enter kindergarten ready to learn. In K-12, only 72% of Oregon high school students graduate with a diploma. A year ago, it was 68%. Putting Oregon near the bottom, if not at the bottom, of all other states. We want to reach our 40-40-20 goal, and right now we're at approximately, and we talked about this the other day, 31%, 17%, and 42%, with 10% not completing within 5 years. Strategic plan. So for the Oregon Department of Education in particular, it means that we've had to take stock of who we are, what we're about, and how we do our work. In particular, and as a first step, it meant reviewing our mission and developing a detailed strategic plan to align our mission, goals, objectives, metrics, and resources with all the changes that I just laid out. And there are a significant number, as we've talked about a couple of times today. This plan forms the basis for the initial phase of my presentation today. And I want to spend a little bit of time taking you through the parts of our strategic plan so that you understand the document and how we use it. So our strategic plan was first created in the fall of 2012, I started in basically August 1st, 2012, and we went to write to work on this piece of work. And we've updated it approximately every 6 months as we work through the process, and it was put together with input from the department, the governor's office, the Oregon Education Investment Board, and many of our education partners. And in the strategic plan document, we set multiple outcome targets for ourselves, our students, and education in the state. And it's important for you to see it because, and this is really important to me, this isn't just a plan that we made and that we put in a book and that we put up on a shelf. This is the plan that we work. I mean, this is what we're doing at the Department of Education and really how we're thinking about the education endeavor in the state of Oregon. This is a plan that we put together that we follow and that we work every single day at the department, and that schools and districts work in their own way across the state on a regular basis. And so I think it's important for you to see this and understand how it works. And it is how we're thinking about making improvements in our system and in ourselves and in an effort to improve the outcomes that we are able to achieve with students.
Rob, I have a couple questions. When you developed your strategic plan, how many participants did you have, and did you have teachers, did you have parents, could you give us a little bit more of a description and of who were the participants in this? And the other part of this is, this a 5-year strategic plan, 10-year strategic plan? I hear that you're reviewing it every 6 months, which is amazing because most strategic plans are reviewed once a year to see how you're meeting your goals and how things are going. So I'm looking at the kind of the foundation of who were the people that helped you design this.
Co-chair Comp, that's a great question, and I'm trying to think back several years ago to the process that we used to design this. We began our work initially very central with the department specifically, especially around the mission and the values. And I say that because there were a couple different pieces of work that we needed to accomplish. We needed to change the culture of the department to some degree, and so we needed to do some work internally about what was our mission as a department and what were our values as a department. And then that was a very significant work that was very internal to us. And also we began some work with people within the department about what the strategic plan could or should look like, just in its very form and nature and how it's constructed. We also worked really closely with OEIB. At that point in time, Dr. Crew was new on the scene and was working on especially some of the high-level goals that we were targeting. And so they had some public outreach through the Oregon Education Investment Board, and then we did some public outreach also at the department. I would think that we could have done more. I think probably you can almost always do that we could have done more, but we did have some input from administrators, certainly in the field, superintendents, a few teacher educators in the state, and some parents. We've gotten more of that over time as we've worked to refine it and look at it and think about it. And I think that we've gotten better at that piece of work. We also were in a pretty good sprint in that first 6 months trying to get things moving and underway. I think what you will see as you look at this, that some of the goals that we set, and I'll call this out when we get to them, probably were not great measurement pieces, not great metrics. They were very high. I don't mind having a really high goal and not achieving it. That doesn't bother me too much. But hopefully I'll be able to explain what some of those look like and where we are. I do think that what we chose really changed our thinking about what it was we were trying to do and what we were attempting to do as a system and how big of a thing it is that we're working to try to move. When the length of the strategic plan, it was from 2012, and it ends this June 30th. So June 30th, 2015 is technically the end of the strategic plan. So as you can imagine, we're involved in a process now to create our new one. I would think that it won't look too different than the one that we have now, but certainly the metrics and the goals that we set out for ourselves will look different, and some of the plans and procedures that we are following, what we call tactics within the plan, what is it technically that we're trying to do, and what piece of work we're trying to accomplish at any given time, will change. And we've been willing to review and modify those things on a six-month basis as we review what our progress looks like.
Thank you.
But there will be a new set of metrics that we'll adopt. We hope, I believe that the timeline that I'll show you in this presentation says by September of 2015. I thought so. So we created our mission statement through a very collaborative process at the department specifically. The Oregon Department of Education fosters excellence for every learner through innovation, collaboration, leadership, and service to our education partners. My favorite part is the part that says fosters excellence for every learner, because it's student-centered and that's what we need to be about. We also set some value statements around equity, quality, results, service, leadership, teamwork, and the people that we have working in the department as our greatest asset as we attempt to do this work, and we've held to those values. And I think that we would reaffirm those if we go through a process to review those this year. There are five major goals that are contained. I'll get my clicks up to speed here. There are five major goals that are contained within our strategic plan. They are around learners, which are our main focus, that students graduate prepared. Educators, that educators are of high quality and are effective in the work that they do. Schools and districts, that each is high performing. Communities, that we have good partnerships, that we're inclusive, and we have a focus on equity, and that ODE is a high-functioning entity and a good place to work. We can't really do our work unless we are high-functioning, and so we want to make sure that we focus on that as well. So this is the very first page of our strategic plan, and I'm going to dive into this for a little while. So if you can bear with me, it would be great. As I said, this is the plan that we're working. And I'd be happy to give you all the complete set of documents that come with this if you would like. Unless you actually request it, I probably won't. But I will go through it and try to give you a sense of the layout and the things that we're working on.
And Rob, what's your goal to get through today so that we don't ask you too many? I won't keep asking you too many questions.
Co-Chair Comp, if I could actually move through the strategic plan today, that would be terrific.
Okay, and that's about how many slides? Mm-hmm. Another 10 or so?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you.
Something like that.
We'll do that.
Okay. And if I see Mr. Wilson checking that out for me.
It's actually about 18 or so, I
okay.
think.
Okay.
Okay. I'll quit asking questions.
So, Co-Chair Comp, we may not make it through, and if you'd like to ask questions, that'd be great. If I make it through part of this, that'd be terrific. I wouldn't want to stifle questions too much. There may be some. So you'll see on this page our goal, the objective. There are five objectives under goal one, and goal one is all about students, and then the objectives under that are also all about students at various levels along the education continuum. And then you'll also see out to the right of that in the blue box the metrics, and those metrics are targets, the numerical outcomes that we're trying to accomplish by the last day of June this year. What you don't see on this page are the things that I referred to earlier that we call tactics, which are the actual smaller steps that we plan and take to accomplish the objectives and the metrics. And so there, I'll show you some of the tactics as we move along so that you get a sense of what it is that I'm talking about when I call it that. We've broken down the plan into six-month progress checks that we call milestones. And each of these are reported on every 6 months in a detailed effort to track progress and so that we can make adjustments if we need to on our targets, or at least our tactics. And we call this tracking system our stock take, because it's a system for us to take stock on how we're doing on our work. It's been an invaluable system that really keeps us moving on a complex and challenging effort. And you'll see when looking at this slide that the goals that we set were very high, and maybe in reality, impossibly high. They did come to pass under the leadership of Dr. Crew, and we adopted the goals, the same ones as the Oregon Education Investment Board. So if you look at these metrics, they'll match the metrics that the OEIB has in its strategic plan, and it wouldn't be appropriate if they were different. And so they do match up. because they were higher, I do think it made us think about it differently and drove us toward improvement. And I'll talk about some of that in the next dozen slides or so, or maybe it's 17. And essentially, they made us think about bigger and deeper investments instead of scattered small investments, and that will be a theme that I talk about as I move through this presentation. So this would be representative of one of the slides that I see when we bring staff together from the various departments, and I say, let's do a stock take and really understand where we are on the various components of our system. And I thought it would be important for you to see what that looks like so you understand how we do this and track it. And here you'll see an objective for goal one broken out into an honest assessment of where we are. This comes from the last stock take that we did around goal one. And we break these out into four components. Planning, which is the first box, and typically you'll see it being sort of this color that we call amber green. Capacity, evidence, and then likelihood of success. So capacity is, do we have what we need in order to make this happen when it comes to staff and resource? Evidence is, what do we show from the current data that we're collecting about how we're doing? And then likelihood of success is, are we going to actually achieve the goal that we set for ourselves or not? If it was completely green, which you don't see any green on this, it means it's done. We've accomplished it. There's nothing left to do. Amber green means it's on track. Amber red means it's in danger. And red means it's just not going to happen. We're not going to make it. And so you'll see for objective one, which was integrate early learning so that every student enters kindergarten ready to learn, that planning is on track and we have a good plan in place. The capacity is amber red. There are some places where we don't have enough capacity to make this happen. We're getting that capacity and some of the requests that we'll be making to you in this presentation and that Megan Irwin will be talking about would be about getting the capacity in place to turn that into something that would be green instead of amber green or amber red, I'm sorry. And then evidence is amber green. And then lastly, we have amber red in the likelihood of success. So you can see that's the case in the majority of our goal one area. The poorest of these is in objective two. And objective two is implementing literacy programs so that all students read by third grade. And here you see red in both capacity and likelihood for success. And I'm going to take you through some of the information in the next set of slides that leads to our conclusions in several of these areas and what we intend to do about it. So I want to talk about why that's red, why it's amber green, and why it's amber red as well, so that you understand that, and then also talk about what it is that we plan to fix it.
Yes, Senator Thompson.
Madam Coach, I see blue and black.
Well,
it's okay. It's okay. He sees differently than many of us.
And Senator Thompson, yes, black and blue is okay because that's, you know, those are the bruises. Those red spots there, they're black and blue.
But white and gold is okay too.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Co-Chairs Kaufman Monroe, Senator Thompson, I may see black and blue after I try to explain why a couple of those are red. And you know, the really sad part about it is that these represent outcomes for our kids in the state. We set a goal around third grade reading, and we're not making it. And so, I mean, that's what that red mm-hmm. box out there means. Mm-hmm. And I really would love to see that be green one day before I retire as an educator. That would be fabulous. So that would be what I'd like to talk about today and maybe a little bit here and how we might be able to get there. So I'll move forward and just show you a little bit of data on this. So this is a graph showing our spring 2014 data on student reading. And it's 2014 data because that's the last time that we've done any kind of an assessment that's a statewide assessment that tells us where we are on third grade reading. You'll see that we have a downward trend in the percentage of students reading in third grade over time. So 2012, 2013, 2014 is a downward trend. And that down from 72.3% of students in 2012 to 68.2% in the spring of 2014. And our targets for this were 77.9% by 2014 and then eventually for 80% by this spring. And that's a target that we're not realistically going to meet, and that's why it's red on our stock take, because we're not going to get there.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hoffman.
So, Rob, what changed in the last few years? Yeah. Why have you I know you're asking that, but have you identified something you could share?
Right. Short answer on that particular one is that we've done some things around improving reading, I think, in the state, but they've been very small pieces of work. And then on top of that, we changed some things about the assessment and the way that we give it that I think it accounts for the most part for this reduction. So we used to tell districts that students could take the assessment three times. And what districts did a lot of the time, I know my district did, is that they would, as soon as the assessment window opened up in October, students would take the assessment. And then you'd review those results. And for any student that passed the assessment, if you were really smart, you wouldn't have them take it again. That isn't necessarily what happened, but it probably is not best practice to have them take it again. And then in February, there would be more students who would take the assessment, and a few students who hadn't passed it would now pass it. And the fact that maybe you missed it by one question previously, and now you pass it by one question, and it, you know, on a statewide basis, it changes the percentage by a couple, 3%. I mean, this is 5-6% is the difference here. Total, and it accounts probably for the majority of this, but not for all of it. I just don't think I don't think that we're doing as well. And then students would take it. One of the things that districts did sometimes then is for students who were not passing the assessment, they would focus program on those students to make sure they got extra support very quickly. And so some of that would be after school program, for example. There were lots of ways that districts went about that. This was a significant point of discussion in my old district when I first got there, because the practice at that point in time was that any student who hadn't met the benchmark and was like within 3 points of meeting the benchmark, got extra support. And then we would give the test again, and oftentimes those students that got extra support then would get over the benchmark. And the point of contention was whether or not that was appropriate. Because wouldn't it be that any student that hasn't met the benchmark needs support, and in fact those that really need the support are the ones who were 10 points below the benchmark? But districts kind of got to a place where they weren't doing that. They were supporting students who were just below, because it came about getting over a bar mm-hmm. with the vast majority of students, not helping all students learn, which is really problematic. And those were decisions that people like me as decision makers in districts made. And so we, you know, took on a philosophy that not any student who hadn't met it was going to get extra support. But there were various places I watched districts around the state battle this very question, and part of it is how much resource do we have to either support some kids or all kids when they're not making the benchmark, and what does this mean anyway? What does it mean when our report card says X about a school or about a district in general if the whole point of it isn't to improve student learning? And so once in a while we create these weird incentives that get strange action. Right, and so we have to be really careful about what we incent, how we talk about it, why the report card is important, how we test, all those kinds of things. This is going away. We're not going to test three times anymore. Right now in the state, the only students who can test three times are our 11th graders, and that has to do with, you know, meeting the essential skills, and there are multiple ways actually to do that. We've reduced the number of times to 2 for everyone else, and we've said we strongly encourage that if a student passes it, they don't take it again. Once in a while you get a parent who says, well, my student only met and I want them to exceed, I want them to take it again, and they'll write that out, and then you give it to that student a second time to see if you can get them to exceed, if they'll exceed or not. And all that goes away this spring. From now on in the state of Oregon, you get to take the assessment one time. And it won't be the old Oaks assessment, it'll be the Smarter Balanced assessment. And you only get to take it once, which reduces the amount of testing time that we would otherwise spend, and it cleans up some data. The more chances you get to do something, the more likely you are to succeed, right? That's why you want to buy 3 balls when you try to knock over the milk bottles at the fair instead of just 1. And so that's part of the reason that the scores went, that the percentage went down, my simplest answer.
Senator Thompson.
Sure. Is that testing, is that what's coming up in March, or what time would that testing be?
Co-chairs Coffin Monroe, Senator Thompson, yes, March 10th is when the window opens for Smarter Balance, and it runs really from March 10th until the end of the school year. Previously with Oaks, the assessment system ran more or less from about October 15th till nearly the end of the school year. It was open a really long time. We've tightened that window up, and you get to take it once.
Well, if you've been in education long enough, the reality is that was the way we did it in the early 90s, and now we've gone full circle. We used to just test once a year, and then we started doing the Oaks, and now we're going back to once a year.
Manager.
It's like everything in education. What comes around goes around.
Uh-huh.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you. And Rob, you and I had talked several months ago about a plan or how you were going to proceed in using or not using the information from this first SBAC testing. Can you elaborate on that just a bit, since we are nearing the point of testing?
Yes,
how is that stuff going to be used?
Co-chairs Coffin Monroe, Representative Huffman. Yes, it is the first time we've ever used this assessment. We anticipate the rollout is going to go pretty smoothly, but there'll be a few hiccups here and there, and then we also want to make sure that the data are reliable when we get them back. And so it will not be used to evaluate educators, and that's an important consideration, obviously, for many and for me as well. And it will not be used to rate schools. So we've always used the assessment data to put a rating system on schools. And so it won't rate schools. We'll use it simply, we'll get the results back, we'll be able to tell what percent met or exceeded on any component of the assessment and the overall assessment in English language arts and in math. And we'll have that data available. Certainly educators, schools, districts, and the communities will see those results, but there won't be any ratings or rankings that go along with that.
And for the students?
Yes, thank you. It's the most important consideration. I apologize. For the students, students will get back their scores at all grade levels. If you're an 11th grader, you'll get back your score. And this is a little bit complex, but there'll be two testing, or there'll be two passing levels. One that I would call a system-wide passing level, so it would be between our state and the other 20 states who have adopted this same assessment. There is a passing level for that. It's a really high passing level. And then there is a passing level for the state of Oregon that you need to pass in order to demonstrate that you've mastered that content for an Oregon diploma. So if it's an English language arts, or it would be that you've met a certain level, that you can demonstrate you've mastered the essential skills in reading English language and arts. And there's a score that you need to achieve in order to be able to do that. Now, in Oregon, there are multiple ways to do that. You can take another assessment called the Work Keys, for example. You don't have to do it on the Smarter Balance assessment. Or you can do it through a classroom work sample, the ACT, the SAT, the PSAT. So there are a number of different assessments and or demonstrations of learning that you can use to earn your essential skill.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kump. I just wanted to find out if are all the teachers in the state, have they received the same type of instruction about how to explain to the students what the test is, what they're going to take? I mean, is there some uniformity? Because I've heard some concerns that maybe there's a lack of uniformity of how the teachers have been instructed to explain how things are going forward. I'm just curious.
Co-Chair Scott Monroe, Representative Taylor. From a technical standpoint, yes. Okay. There is a very specific set of training and a test delivery manual, and all that is supposed to be done, and we provide lots of training about very technically, correctly, how it is it that you administer the assessment.
Mm-hmm.
What gets communicated to students specifically, we certainly know what we like to have, and we've communicated that out,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, there's lots of different thinking and opinion about the assessment, and how that gets communicated to students will vary, I think, just about the assessment and what it is and why and that kind of thing. How you actually give it will be done very similarly across the state.
Mm-hmm. And then follow up?
Yes.
And then there's some sort of information that will be sent out to the parents, obviously, ahead of time, so that, like with the OAKS test, we were always notified when, at least in Portland Public Schools, that the test was coming up, so you made certain that your child was there and prepared and that type of thing. Is that?
Co-Chairs Conference Rural Representative Taylor, I believe the answer to that is yes. I'm not 100% certain, but I think it is. I'll check back to you tomorrow on that.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Thompson and Senator Roblin.
Just a quick measuring thing. So that achievement test, and you say the bar is fairly high. What my thinking is GPA, or would you say it takes an A student to reach that achievement, a B student, a C student? Where would you think that is to meet that achievement?
Co-Chairs Conference Monroe, Senator Thompson, love the question. While my assessment people would say, you can't answer it that way, Rob, because students earn A's and B's for lots of different kinds of behaviors. Maybe because they turn their homework in when another student doesn't turn their homework in, and what we want to know is what a student knows. But to be simple about your question, I would say it's probably a B, okay. B plus okay. kind of thing. So here's the scale that we have on Smarter Balanced. And these won't mean anything, but I'll try to make them mean something. So right now, in order to pass the Oregon Assessment of Knowledge and Skills, the test we give now, you need what's called a 236. The scale score means, like, not a lot, right? In general, at the high school level, three or four points is about a year's worth of instruction. Okay, so, and the score on the new assessment would be roughly equivalent to a 242 or a 243.
Okay.
So a 243 compared to a 236
yeah.
is like, you know, 1.5, roughly 2 years of instructional content. It's a lot higher. I'll translate it to college because we've done a couple of analyses where we've done a regression analysis. So if you take the OAKS and you pass the OAKS, there's about a 50-50 chance that you'll get a B in your comparative freshman college class. So if I pass with a 236 in math, I probably will get a B in my freshman college. 50-50 chance I'll get a B in my freshman college class in math, whatever it happens to be. Yeah, on the Smarter Balance, there's a 65% likelihood if I pass the Smarter Balance score, there's a 65% likelihood I'll get a B minus or higher in my resulting class. It's the same set level as a college and career readiness standard on the ACT, the SAT, and it's equivalent about to the NAEP, the National Assessment of Education Progress score. I apologize sometimes if I answer too long. I try to be precisely correct.
Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions about assessment. The first one just is, has there been, as you developed this new test, a real equity lens looked at it? We have equity based in everything else, and we know the history of all of our other testing has not been, that's not been one of the lenses that's really taken a high look. We look at the results and recognize that kids of different groups don't do well, but we've never looked at the test itself to discern whether it's the way we ask the question, the syntax that we ask the question in, and the words that we use that we ask the question in that make the difference. And I worry about that as we introduce a new test.
Co-chairs Compton Rowe, Senator Rowland, wonderful question. And again, assessment people at the department always say, Rob, quit answering it that way. But I do like to be pretty transparent. So bottom line is, I've never seen an assessment that doesn't have some cultural bias. It just doesn't exist. The question is this test the best that's ever been created in relation to cultural bias? And I believe the answer to that is yes.
Okay.
They've done more work, and they've had more committees and more verification through people who have come together that are actually called bias committees to review every single question and say, what does this look like when it comes to cultural bias, and have we removed it as much as possible from the assessment? Yes, it's a highly technically expert assessment that has removed cultural bias to the degree that I would say it's as good as any test ever developed in that area. Will there be some cultural bias in it? I can't imagine that there's an assessment that's ever been given that doesn't have it.
Okay. My follow-up?
Yes, please.
So my follow-up has to do with, in most of these other tests that we've had over the past number of years, there have been a fairly large block of test questions that have been available to instructors to use as they do their formative assessment going along the year so that they can get kids ready for the kind of questions that are going to be there. Is that group of questions been developed, and do the teachers have access to them so they can introduce it as time goes on so that it won't look totally new to them when they wander in to take a test?
Co-chairs Coffin, Senator Roblin, yes. There is a bank of assessment questions and some sample assessments that are available online that parents and kids can access. I don't think it's as robust as the ones that we've maybe previously had, but it does exist. And it will become more robust over time. They also have developed a battery of what are called interim and formative assessments. I think the formative assessments are sort of a different set. The interim assessments are more similar to what's on the Smarter Balance specifically, and also are predictive to some degree of how students will do on the assessment eventually in each area that the formative assessment is offered in. And so Smarter Balance has developed those. There is a cost that goes with those. It's one of the lowest costs. It's about $4, I think, per student per year if you buy the full bank. Some districts in the state have done that, and some have not. There are other interim informative assessments that are very good that are available also that districts have chosen to purchase instead.
Okay.
Now that we finally got to the point that I'm pretty persistent about is the cost, and it's my understanding that the Smarter Balance will cost us almost twice as much as the Oaks, and you might as well throw that figure out there so we don't have culture shock when the,
I was just going to ask that, so it's perfect.
Yeah, well, it's considering we're only giving the test once a year instead of three times a year, but yet the cost is doubled, it's like this doesn't calculate unless you're looking at a inverted parabola.
Co-Chair Comp, yes, the cost is about double. I was looking for the total all-in cost. I believe it's about, the all-in cost for the biennium is about $24 million for the assessment. The federal government gives us $11 million, I think it is, for the biennium, and the state of Oregon picks up the rest.
I don't know, it's just a real, it's a bummer. Representative Smith Warner, and then Rep. Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are there further costs to the districts, or is that one statewide cost and then all the districts just get to utilize it?
Co-Chairs Conklin, Representative Smith Warner, that is the all-in cost, and it does not cost districts anything beyond that other than the administration time and or any technology that they use to offer it.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Rep. Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Comp. And so I just want to go back to something you said earlier. So the, just to clarify, the districts are, for the other additional tests that you were talking about, did the all the districts in the state give the same types of tests in addition to the Smarter Balance, the same number and type, or is there going to be inconsistencies with testing depending on the district?
Co-Chairs Comp and Rowe, Representative Taylor, inconsistencies depending on the district. So the assessment, the Smarter Balance assessment is standardized. The way that districts go about preparing students to do that or checking on their current learning status is variable across the state and is part of local control.
So,
Senator Roblin.
Thank you. And so clarifying, if you decide that you want to give a battery of these extra questions throughout the year, you're going to pay separately to have those banks available to you. And if there are other groups out there who have developed assessments that would give you a good indication how they're doing, those would also cost extra for the individual districts.
Co-Chairs Comp and Rowe, Senator Roblin, that's correct. If districts decide to do that, that is how that rolls out. As a person who led a couple school districts, my favorite methodology was to provide staff development to the teachers and the educators who were in the system about what good assessment looked like and have them develop the assessments and, if need be, add compensation for that, because it sort of changes the perspective and the skill set forever, as opposed to giving someone a fish, you teach them to fish. If you offer up good statewide staff development and effective use of assessment, you can change the assessment practices across the state and student learning across the state.
Okay, Representative Taylor, and I think we're going to, this would be a great spot to let the deputy superintendent get off the hot seat.
Oh, first, thank you so much for getting this off to a great start. And, I think you do a great job, but I just wanted to understand why would we, and maybe someone else can explain to me, if not you, why are we going to allow different districts to make these decisions? It could be that, what if it could be putting one district at an advantage over another, and therefore the results would come back, and we could be making conclusions about a district's based on their test scores, but perhaps the teachers, students, whomever, were not well prepared. I don't like to bring up personal life situations, but luckily my daughter has a fabulous teacher, and her teacher's been preparing them all along, and she's in the fourth grade. My daughter's all excited for the test after spring break, and she's been told it doesn't mean she's not stupid or anything if she gets it wrong. And then at my son's school, they basically, pretty much nothing's going on. So I'm not quite sure why this is happening. I don't understand. Can maybe you explain it to me, or maybe Senator Roblin can explain this to me.
Co-Chairs Conklin, Monroe Taylor. I'd love to have Senator Roblin do that.
Good answer.
It's not your fault. I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah. Again, you know, if an assessment is a really good assessment,
okay.
This is really important. This is a very important concept. If an assessment is a really good assessment, any preparation you do for the assessment ought to be about what students should know and they should be learning, and it's okay to do. If you have a crummy assessment and what you're doing is teaching kids, for example, how to be smart year after year, might be good to do this once, but year after year about how to figure out strategies around a multiple choice test, or if you're teaching them very finite knowledge and skill set because you know it's going to be on the test, that's a really bad test. We want an assessment that's going to allow students to have to synthesize lots of information and bring the learning that they've had together into something that really determines whether or not they've mastered a skill set. And so if what you're practicing is that, I was up in Staten this last week, and I listened to a couple of the teachers in front of an audience of parents talk about the way that they've altered their instruction because of the Common Core and Smarter Balanced. And they said, we're constantly asking kids to present the evidence that they were able to read and collect from a variety of sources and to synthesize it into an argument. And so we work on argumentation all the time. And I would say that asking students to read for evidence and create argumentation is a wonderful skill. And if that's preparing somebody for the test, go get it, right? That's perfect. It's what we want. That's why the quality of this assessment is so important. And the Oaks assessment was really good at the time that we gave it and developed it. But we made it, we developed it, we kept it, and we didn't change it and adapt it the way, you know, for a long time. Smarter Balanced is completely different than that. There is some multiple choice, but then there's lots of short-generated response. And then there also are writing samples and math problem sets where you actually work out the math problem and it's human scored. That's good assessment. The worst assessments I ever gave as a teacher were multiple choice assessments, and I gave them when I had a day to finish putting together a final grade. I much rather give a really robust assessment 2 or 3 days before I had to turn the grade in and then take my time to read it and then be able to give students good feedback about what they did well or didn't do well. That's a much better kind of assessment. Teaching to that kind of assessment is good teaching. Teaching to a multiple choice assessment is bad teaching.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe.
When I was teaching advanced placement U.S. history for many years, I had copies of their past tests that I used as teaching tools, especially for the essay parts of that advanced placement test, to train my students what kind of questions, what kind of thought processes they're going to have to go through. And I've thought that gave my students a much better chance at getting college credit for their advanced placement work, and the results were such. So I didn't really feel like I was doing anything immoral or illegal by using past tests, because I didn't see the test they were going to take until the day they took it, and it really was a helpful exercise.
Thank you. And I know we're drawing to a conclusion here, and I will try to push a little harder tomorrow since I didn't make it very far through the strategic plan. The one thing I'd like to make before we're done today is that we just had a really good and interesting discussion because I showed you some data. And it was data about where we are on third grade reading right now in the state of Oregon, and we're not where we need to be. Part of it is because the initiatives that we've put together and the work that we've done so far across the state has been fairly disjointed, and it's been small. And you can't move the system, a whole system, with small investment and disjointed pieces of work. The other point I want to make is we only have that data point up there that generated this discussion and has us trying to figure out how to do better because we give an assessment that gives us those data results and tells us about where we are. And it allows us to make good policy. And so that's a really important consideration as we think about what we need to do and how we need to do it in order to make sure students learn as much as possible in this great state.
Good, and that was an excellent conclusion. And with that, I am going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5016 and House Bill 5017. And Senator Monroe, the gavel will be yours tomorrow. We are adjourned.